Okay. The Chafetz Chaim. So, aside from the toned-down joke that I sent out earlier, the Chafetz Chaim arguably is the most popular Jew since Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? I'm not exaggerating. No, popular. Okay? Chasidim, Misnagdim, Dati Leumi, Sfardim. He was the Posek Achron, right? Posek Achron literally means like the bottom line. You ask me what the halacha is, in the old days at least, I don't think it's true anymore, the Mishnah Berurah was the Posek Achron. The Mishnah Berurah told you the answer. What was the Chafetz Chaim's secret? Why was he so popular? Okay, let's do some background. The Chafetz Chaim was born in Grodno in Poland to poor but distinguished parents. I mean, they were frum people. They were as followers of Talmud Chacham. They had no money, but otherwise it was completely good. His father died when he was 10. Okay, sad. His mother remarries a successful Talmud Chacham, meaning he's rich, more or less. He's a Talmud Chacham. His name is Rav Shimon. Okay, and he lives in Vilna, where he learns. So the Chafetz Chaim, obviously with his mom and the rest of his family, moves to Vilna. Now, Rav Shimon had a previous family. His wife also passed away. We'll come back to that in 1 second. Okay? So they're in Vilna. Vilna is, you know, the centerpiece of from Judaism at this time in the 1830s. Again, I'll just say as an aside, we don't really know what year he was born. Like I sent out the obit from the New York Times and said he was 105. He probably wasn't 105, but the Chafetz Chaim refused to celebrate his birthday, so nobody knew when he was born. Okay, but he lived a long, long time. If it wasn't 105 years, so maybe it was only 100. Sue me. Okay, fine. So now he's in Vilna, and it's fantastic. There are a lot of maskilim there, and since the Chafetz Chaim is a gifted student, they're obviously after him, but life is fine for him there. Okay? The Chafetz Chaim gets married when he's 17. Now, this... Can't speak to my mother now. Okay. This is a significant event for the following reason. Okay, he's well-known. He's very short, which is not good for Shiduchim. But if anybody has, like... I have this picture in my sukkah, which is like an actual picture. It's touched up a little bit of the Chafetz Chaim. He's incredibly short. Either that or everybody else is like 7 feet tall. But, okay, that's just the thing. I saw in some book, like, Shiduchim were hard for him because he was so short. But I don't believe that. But here's the thing. You know, he was a big Talmud Chacham, and he was worth a lot on the market. Like, in those days, you know, you bought a chassan for your son, and he had big offers for money. Who did he marry? He married a girl named Frida. Now, she's not just any girl. She's his half-sister.
Oh, what?
Meaning... She's the daughter of Rav Shimon. So his they're not related by stepsister. Okay, to me it's all the same thing. I was going to make clear that there's no blood connection between them. Okay, fine. I'm saying, so I used the wrong term. I apologize for using the wrong term. She obviously grew up in the same house as him. Right? And more than that, his mother was very against it. His brother was very against it. Again, because A, there was a lot of money. By the time he married her, they had no money. But B, because you don't do things like this. But the Chafetz Chaim did it. And he's not the first person we've seen this year who went against the advice of his parents in who he married. And I do think that speaks to a strength of character. Like, I don't want to say the Chafetz Chaim fell in love with his adopted, you know, I don't know how that works. But he knew who she was. And his mother said, you can't marry her. And he didn't say tough, but he married her. So I think that really speaks to the independence and the, you know, the strength of character that the Chafetz Chaim had. Okay. They moved to a small town called Radin, which later on becomes famous because it's where the Chafetz Chaim lived. But at the time it wasn't. Where for a few months he's the unpaid rabbi. By most accounts, he was unsuccessful. Again, he didn't want to be paid. He was uncomfortable with the job. So after a few months, he gave up the job. And he basically tutored kids for a while to sort of make a living. But he wasn't really into making a living. 4 years into his marriage, he inherited money, I don't know from whom, and he and his wife bought a store. Okay, most of the famous stories of the Chafetz Chaim, including in the New York Times, have to do with the store. He was obviously incredibly honest, and he did everything to chase down people he had money, he owed money to, and whatever. Either the store was the biggest success ever, meaning like people wanted to buy things from the Chafetz Chaim because of who he was, and so nobody shopped anywhere else, or the store is a complete failure because the Chafetz Chaim didn't really want to make any money, and he just, you know, was willing to charge a tiny bit more than it actually cost him, and it didn't work. Okay, those are the two narratives around the store. But the Chafetz Chaim was becoming, apparently not the force of his personality, but just how he conducted himself. People fell in love with him. Like, if you met the Chafetz Chaim, you're like a Sem girl. You just loved him. Okay, like, there was a way that he carried himself that made him different than other Gedolim. Okay, after or during the store, the Chafetz Chaim opens a yeshiva, which was actually the greatest success of his life and something he was incredibly proud of. He named the yeshiva, Yeshivat Chafetz Chaim, right? His name is actually not the Chafetz Chaim. Kagan is almost certainly just a takeoff on Kohen. He was a Kohen. Pupko might have been like his actual last name. Yisrael Meir is my nephew who's named for his grandfather, who's named for the Chafetz Chaim. Okay? Everybody loves the Chafetz Chaim. Yes? Schmidman is his last name. That's not what you want?
Sorry. I have a friend who's a Pupko who said that he took it from marrying the Chafetz. He took it somehow through marriage. That Pupko.
Okay, if it was the Chafetz Chaim's last name, I would take it also. Okay, maybe it was the other person's name. Okay, now, he opens the yeshiva. That's a big success. He then writes a sefer with the same name as the yeshiva. The sefer is called Chafetz Chaim, and it's obviously because the Chafetz Chaim devoted himself to what? To the issur of Lashon Hara, to the issur of slander. This was a big deal for the Chafetz Chaim. Now, let's talk about it for a second. He got Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, to write a haskama to his sefer Chafetz Chaim, which was a sefer, you know, telling you the evils of Lashon Hara. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wrote in the hakdama that he disagrees with one point, right? The Chafetz Chaim said that a person who has to do tshuva for speaking Lashon Hara has to do tshuva. If that includes going to the person and saying to him, I said this about you, you know, and I'm sorry, then you have to do it. Now, Rousseau Salanter said, you can't possibly be that you would go to a person and hurt his feelings by telling him, I said all these bad things about you and I want to apologize. Rousseau Salanter thought that couldn't be the halacha. But the Chafetz Chaim thought it could be the halacha, and it was the halacha. And I think it has to do with the way you look at it. For the Chafetz Chaim, the halachos of Lashon Hara aren't like something made up. It's not like, you know, well, we want to make Lashon Hara seem like it's a real Isser, so we'll make up halachos around it. For the time, Lashon Hara was a real Isser. It was like Basar B'Chalav. So he would say to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, I don't know, if doing tshuva for eating Basar B'Chalav involved telling somebody that you know, make somebody feel bad, you would have to do it. Because you violated an Isser D'Oraisa of Basar B'Chalav. So to get kapara, you have to do tshuva. Whatever the tshuva is, you have to do it, right? The greatness of the Chafetz Chaim, and the Nitziv said this, he also wrote a haskama to the Chafetz Chaim, he said is that he turned Lashon Hara into a normative part of Judaism. It's not like here are the halachas that you have to abide by, and here are the things that you should do if you want to be a tzaddik. No, it's an absolute issur to speak Lashon Hara, and you have to treat Lashon Hara the way you would treat any other part of halacha. Yes?
Wouldn't the great comparison to Basar B'Chalav be for when the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was trying? It's not that if someone would feel bad, it's that if the whole point of Lashon Hara is in terms of...
You agree with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, it's fine with me.
If I had to do some other issur of Basar B'Chalav, to choose for Basar B'Chalav, that's
no
point, no.
No. If somebody served you basar b'chalav, you would tell them that you served me basar b'chalav. it would hurt their feelings, but you would do it. I think that's what it is. Okay, it's not the right comparison. Yes?
What was his makor for letting her being actual?
Oh, there are tons of them. You know, lo samar al damar. There's a million psukim.
No, that, but I'm saying, like, if it was not some makor, there was a lot of them, why?
So, you know, why the Shulchan, the Rambam has it. Why the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have halachas of Lashon Hara, I don't know. But again, that's what he did. And how did he do it? This is an important point philosophically, but it really matters. The Chafetz Chaim said, and he believed this deeply, the Chafetz Chaim said that the enemy of the good is the perfect. The reason why everybody here, when they hear Lashon Hara, thinks, right, that's what we all think. Is because we know we're going to do it again. Right? Shmira Shabbos. I'm pretty sure, you know, God willing, unless something terrible happens, that I'm not going to be Mechal Shabbos this week. But I'm likely, probably, it's probably likely that I'll speak some Lashon Hara on Shabbos. Now, so what does that mean? So the Chafetz Chaim will say, okay, you don't have to be perfect. Chafetz Chaim had a mashal. He said, if you're on the beach, and diamonds start, like, coming in with the tide. So they come in with the tide, they go out with the tide. You take as many as you could. You're not going to get all of them, because there's a gazillion, you know, things on the beach. But you'll take as many as you could. Why wouldn't you do the same thing with Lashon Hara? He said improving in Lashon Hara is what you're after, not being perfect. And I could tell you this. I think it was his son. Chafetz Chaim obviously lived a long time. He got remarried. I think I met his son in Teaneck, but it could be it was his grandson. Okay, he'd have to be very old, it's true. But his son or his grandson said the following. You would think that my grandfather, I suppose, or my father, didn't speak much. Because he's the Chafetz Chaim, and he wants to be really, really careful about Lashon Hara. But the answer is, he said, he was a chatty guy. He talked all the time. He just didn't speak Lashon Hara, right? There is a way for you to be, you know, a friendly, open, happy person without speaking Lashon Hara. You look like you're in pain.
Yeah, he didn't have children.
No, he had plenty of children. Yeah. We'll get to the Chazon Ish. He didn't have children. Excellent. I know who you meant. He had children. He had grandchildren. Maybe this guy. Okay, anyway. So that's an important thing. And again, what motivated him to write the Sefer was this idea. You know, he thought it couldn't be that you're frum, but you speak Lashon Hara. It couldn't be that you're frum, but you eat treif. It couldn't be that you're frum, but you're mechal shabbos. Couldn't, it just can't be. And so, you know, the problem is that we've put Lashon Hara into a category that's different than other halacha. For example, I think it can't be that you're frum and you smoke. It's also to smoke. But because it's rational, because it has to do with medicine, because goyim think it's a bad idea. So we think, how usur could it be? If the goy thinks it's usur, it must be okay. Right? Goyim are against Lashon Hara, for the most part. Okay? Maybe they speak. I don't know that goyim speak more Lashon Hara than we do. I never made a test of this. But the Chafetz Chaim would not stomach this, and he couldn't. Okay. How did he sell his sefer? So he sold his sefer by going from town to town and giving shiur. I mean, everybody who met him fell in love with him, right? And he went, he later on used to walk around talking about Shmir Shabbos and things like that. He got people to subscribe for the sefer. When he got 1,000 subscriptions, he didn't take any money. He had then collected enough money to print the sefer. He then printed the sefer and sent it to all the people. Okay, that's the Chafetz Chaim. Now, he also wrote plenty of Sfarim. But one of the Sfarim that he wrote was a sefer called Machane Yisrael. It was for people who were being drafted into the Tsar's army. Right? We've come across this before. The Tsar was anti-Semitic, and one of the ways that he got Jews to convert to Christianity was to get them into his army and to basically cut them off from a previous life. The Chafetz Chaim was not, you know, he basically didn't paskin that you couldn't go to the army. In fact, he was against lying. Okay, not surprising. He was not in favor of lying, even to get out of the army. Okay, so he wrote a sefer about how a person can maintain his frumkeit in the army. You know, not surprisingly, he thought people should wear tzitzis. He thought there were increasing or decreasing levels of kashrus. meaning, okay, you can't get kosher food in the Tsar's army. What do you eat? So the Chafetz Chaim says, you know, first you try to be a vegetarian if it's good, right? He thought you could compromise, and he thought there were ways to deal with it. Okay, whether it's true or not, I don't know. Again, he traveled extensively to encourage Shmiras Shabbos, to encourage Taras HaMishpacha. He thought it was a tragedy that Frum people were stopped. Apparently in his day, there were women who believed that going to the bath at home was the same as going to a mikvah. Okay, this really worked him up, and he went around talking about why we have to be more careful about it. Yes?
Sorry, when you say degrees of keeping kosher, do you mean like...
I mean like Issus D'Oraisa, Issus D'Rabbanans.
Oh, but not like I'm going to go with Hashgacha, not with Hashgacha.
No, no, in the Tsar's army, there was no Hashgacha. Like, you know, you couldn't, you know... I guess you could say only eat the charedis because you're not going to eat the Tsar's food. But there's no, you know, it doesn't work that way. Okay. Then he writes the Mishnah Bura, which of course becomes the Sefer. By the way, I think it took a while for it to be the Sefer. Rav Schechter mentioned that he didn't have a Mishnah Bura until he got married. Right? That's what he said. So, yes?
I was like, I the theory is that it happened.
You also didn't?
What? What?
You also didn't have a Mishnah Berurah until you got married?
I'm not a Mishnah Berurah.
What? Okay, well, nowadays, I think you could do it. I think
no,
that
the theory as to why it didn't go public later is because after World War II, a lot of the new communities were founded by people that followed the Chafetz Chaim, unless they spread the Mishnah Berurah and popularized it. But a lot of the post-World War II communities.
Okay. Okay, now, how did it become popular? It's simple. The Chafetz Chaim wrote it. I mean, he's a mythic figure. And he's a Baal Musar. Like, till then, his most famous Sefer was a Sefer about Shmiras HaLashon. So when the person who writes a Shmiras HaLashon also writes a halachic work, right, he's both. Usually we have, okay, this guy's a big Talmud Chacham. Okay, he's not so into the other stuff. Well, this guy's a big Baal Musar, so he's not a big Talmud Chacham. When somebody becomes both, each side, you know, impacts the other side. When the person who cares so much about Shmiras HaLashon writes a black and white halacha sefer, so that sefer becomes very popular. Okay, but you're right, it still took time for the Chafetz Chaim, for the sefer itself, the Mishnah Berurah, to become popular. Maybe you're right that, you know, it only becomes popular after World War II. Obviously, there was nothing during the Holocaust, so, you know, I think there's truth to that. Okay, there are three real motivations for writing the sefer, and all of them are reflected in its popularity. One, says the Chafetz Chaim, people need to understand the reasoning behind the halacha in order to connect to it, not in order to observe it. But if you want to feel, like you're invested in a halacha, you need to know the rationale. This could be, you know, a remnant of the Haskalah movement. They were all into rationales and understanding things, or it could just be what he thought. Okay, second, new cases arise all the time, right? New technology, new applications of halacha. So you need rules to apply. Okay, so the Mishnah Berurah is very big on rules. And finally, somebody needed to summarize what Achronim had said over the past 250 years. Like, there had been no halacha sefer, no new halacha sefer, and that was the number one need. And so the Chafetz Chaim took upon himself to write the sefer. It is not a summary of Shulchan Aruch. In fact, sometimes he doesn't even paskin at all. He gives you a bunch of options, and he leaves it up to you. Yes?
So, do we paskin 100% like the
Mishnah? No. So again, when I was a kid, people said, you paskin like the Mishnah Berurah. He's the Posek Achron. I think that there's no sefer that could be the Posek Achron for more than 75 to 100 years. I think just so many things happen that my sense is it's no longer, you know, people don't refer to the Mishnah Berurah anymore as the Posek Achron. What really happened in the history of halacha and the development of halacha is a bunch of books on topics. Like Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa was the first book that came out. Why would you look in the Mishnah Berurah if you could look in Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa? You know, Kitzer Hilchasa Sfiras HaOmer. Three volumes on Amen. It may be a joke, I'm not sure. That's a whole question. There's all these books you could get now, you know, Hilchos Tztaka, Hilchos Maiser Sheni. What? No, Pnei Halacha is a competition to the Mishnah Berurah. Pnei Halacha is not on a topic, it's on everything.
It's not as broad as the Mishnah Berurah, though. It's
broader, because the Mishnah Berurah is only on Aruch Chaim. Pnei Halacha goes beyond that. Okay? I think till he got himself in trouble politically, he was going to replace the Mishnah Berurah in Israel. Rav Melamed? Rav Melamed. So add some things with Rav, you know, let's just say he didn't immediately passel everybody who's not from, and the frumer people basically tried to write him out of existence. But otherwise, it would have been, and it's some form of, okay? Now, how did it become so popular? First of all, obviously, it's written by the Chafetz Chaim. Everybody loves the Chafetz Chaim. Second, it was written for us. It was not written for Talmidei Chacham. He says this in his introduction. The point is to tell regular Jews what to do. He also basically avoided all of the controversial topics. So there's nothing about electricity. There were now trains. There's nothing about traveling about a train on Shabbos. There's nothing about machine matzahs. There's nothing about machine tzitzis. He basically left those things out so he didn't get into big fights with people. Everybody wants to know, is the Mishnah Berurah a machmir or a mekil? So it's not really a fair question to ask of anybody, and it's not really a fair question to ask of him. I'll give you two examples that make him a sensitive posek, not a machmir or a mekil. Okay? He was mekil on grape juice for Kiddush on Shabbos. Okay? It's Simon Kuf Ayin Bet. And when he was attacked for it, apparently he said, well, you guys come from whatever town, which is a rich town. In Radin, we can't afford wine. So I was makil on grape juice. So it was clear he knew he was being makil, and he was doing it for purposes of the fact that, you know, in his town, people couldn't afford wine. They were very, very poor, and that was a justifiable reason for him. In Kuf Ayin Hay, he's also matir learning on Shabbos with a wax candle. In the Mishnayos of Bamei Madlikin, it's Asur, right? But he said, our candles nowadays are much better. Also, they didn't have electricity. They needed it, okay? Those are examples where he's Mekil, but I don't think you could just say that he's Mekil. I think he presents a range of options. And this is really the main point I want to make about the Mishnah Berurah. He presents a range of options, and then he urges people to be Machmir, right? He says things like Tov Lahachmir, V'baal nefesh yachmir al atzmo, right? He doesn't tell you have to do it, but he urges you to do it. There are two famous stories of Rav Amital that relate to this. A guy brought, you know, came to him to ask him a question, and he was mekel for him, and he said, but the Mishnah Berurah says, you know, baal nefesh yachmir al atzmo. And Rav Amital said to the guy, that's the difference between me and you. When you see it say baal nefesh yachmir al atzmo, you think he's talking to you. I don't think he's talking to me when he says that. Okay, that it's a whole perspective on life. Rav Amital also told me a story. He had a friend who made Aliyah, who asked him. He said, "Yehuda, you know what kind of Jew I am. What chumras in terms of mitzvah satulias bards should I keep?" It's a fantastic story. Rav Amital believes in it deeply, which is, you don't get to. You could be machmir as much as you want, but it doesn't mean anything. It has to, to be machmir on things that don't make sense for a person like you. Doesn't make sense. I didn't mean you. I meant me. I meant, right? There are chumras that make sense for people like us. There are chumras that don't. And Rav Amital thought that mattered, and apparently the Mishnah Berurah thought it mattered also. Okay, anyway, it was the most popular sefer in the world. Why? Everybody loves the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim believed deeply that he was living in Yemos HaMashiach. He wrote a sefer on Kachim, Briskers owe him a lot. He thought, he could be the Kohen Gadol. He was like worked up about this stuff. And so he wrote Sfarim on Kachim. Here's a difficult one. On the one hand, the Chafetz Chaim, I don't want to say he saw what was coming, but he used the word Holocaust, before World War II. I don't know anybody else in the world who used that word. Okay? He was afraid. But he was also afraid of Zionism. Right? He thought living in Eretz Yisrael was a fantastic thing, and he had planned to make Aliyah at some point. A bunch of rabbis talked him out of it. He was worried about the Zionist movement, which he saw correctly as being controlled by Michal Shabbos. And he was, he thought if he invested in that movement, bad things would happen. It's a problem because, then the Holocaust happened. So I'm not saying, God forbid, he saw what was coming. He was nervous about it. On the one hand, he thought we lived in Yemos HaMashiach. On the other hand, he thought a day would come that Jews would be slaughtered by Goyim, and he was stuck in between those two. Again, it's not for me to say. I think it was a mistake not to tell people to get up and move to Israel, or even not to tell people to get up and move to America. His son moved to America. His family of Mendel Zaks, who I met, who published the Mishnah Berurah, who's his son-in-law. You know, these are people who moved to America, I think against the advice of the Chafetz Chaim. He was an absolute folk hero to non-Jews. Non-Jews would try to get the Chafetz Chaim to come to their farms because they believed that if he walked on their fields, right, the field would be blessed. It's like, okay, it's just who he was. There was something about how he handled himself and how he practiced himself that made him different. It was hard for him to give Mussar, but he did give Mussar. Here's a fantastic story. Okay, I actually, many, many years ago, I heard Rav Riskin tell this story. There's a famous story that in Radin, somebody smoked on Shabbos. Okay, it's Chilul Shabbos. And they told the Chafetz Chaim. And the Chafetz Chaim called him into the office, and whatever happened, happened, and now the guy's from, you know. So Riskin said, I told the story, and a guy came up to me afterwards, and he said to me, I'm the guy in the story. You want to know what happened? He said, I came into the office, and the Chafetz Chaim took my hand and put his hands around me and started crying and just said, Shabbos. He said, his tears landed on my hand. I could tell you how it felt now when his tears landed on my hand. They like burned my skin. All he said was Shabbos over and over again, and he let me leave. Okay, that's how you give Mussar, right? We can't do it, but that's how he did it, and it was great. Last thing, his son also said that they, or his grandson, that they never sold a sefer. He made his money from Sfarim. You know, he tried to make the price fair. He said until they looked, he made one of the kids turn every single page of every chelik of Mishneh Berurah before they sold it. He said they were like in the house, there was a stack of Mishneh Berurahs on the table, and you had to look through everyone because sometimes they, you know, the printer makes a mistake and there's an empty page, and the Chafetz Chaim, you know, wouldn't sell the sefer on that basis. He also said that their house backed on a cemetery. There was like a backyard in Radin, and then there was a cemetery. But the Chafetz Chaim, who was a Kohen, never went out the back door because he was afraid, you know, exactly where the cemetery started. So he said the kids, when they wanted to hide from their father, would go in the backyard because their father would never, ever in his life go in the backyard because of the fear of Tumah. Okay, last thing. What's the Chafetz Chaim real secret? His secret is that he was both things. Despite how unique he was what people refer to as a Pashut Yid. He's like, he's just a guy, even though he was the Chafetz Chaim. And in the end, he moved halacha closer to Mussar, making, you know, he made halacha feel softer, like he explained things and he cared about things. And so it was, you know, when you listen to him talk about halacha, you felt that it appealed to you more. He made Mussar harder. Right, like when he was worked up about something, it really mattered. But in between those two poles, I think, is his uniqueness and his greatness. Okay, Yashkoach.